This is the BBC.
This podcast is supported by advertising outside the UK.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile.
With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, how to get 30, how to get 20, 20, 20, how to get 20, 20, how to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
The Scotland Outdoors Podcast from BBC Radio Scotland.
Hello and thanks very much for downloading this podcast. I'm Mark Stephen. As you know, we build this podcast, Scotland Outdoors, out of a live programme we do for BBC Radio Scotland called Out of Doors. This week, because of something called the Big Garden Birdwatch, we were really seriously majoring on birds. I'm sitting here in the snow. Seriously, it is snowing this morning. I've got the fire on. Not like me to complain, you know that. Live from the BBC Aberdeen car park, which is white, coming to you direct from an equally snowy Bonnie Bamshire, Mr. Ewan McElriff.
Yeah, it is absolutely gorgeous morning. I had Bracken out for a walk at about 5 o'clock. She just came out and looked at the snow, rolled on her back and started stretching and just absolutely loving it. It's gorgeous. Good morning. Let us know what you're up to this morning and what this weather is like. You can email us outofdoors@bbc.co.uk. The text number 80295. And Lewis is taking your calls this morning. 08085 92 95 00.
I would say that over the last week, the bird song has changed. It is starting to, believe it or not, even this early in the year, it's starting to come into a sort of spring dawn chorus type feel about it. You know, the birds are getting active earlier in the morning. There's bird song around about the car park here at the moment. We are going very heavy on birds this morning because coming up shortly we'll be hearing how you can get involved with the RSPB's Big Garden Birdwatch. Get in touch to tell us if you've got regular feathered friends visiting your garden. I've been out recording what I have at my bird feeders and you hear more on that very shortly.
Yeah, yesterday morning was the first time I sort of heard that hint of a dawn chorus, and it was a bit of light in the sky. I think it's going to be okay after all. We've got a mystery bird today, and we'll have a listen. Nobody's going to get this, but we might have to give you some clues. Right, we'll have a guess at that. If you know what that is, we will be seriously impressed. You do know, because I told you earlier on.
Yeah, but I wouldn't do.
No, I would have never known either. 0805 92 95 00. They are delightful birds, but we say that every week.
Indeed. Before we head back into the world of birds, a couple of emails relating to last week's Robert Burns programme, in particular about food. Joe Douglas got in touch to say, I was very inspired by your assertion that anything goes for the chief pudding at a barn supper. We don't remember saying that. On finding our local butcher sold out of haggis on Monday past, I attempted to make my own. Pictures attached. Right. My wife referred to them as looking more like twa guinea pigs. Were your guinea pigs involved in some sort of road accident? But they tasted good. Ingredients included leeks, onions, oatmeal, bacon, raisins, that morning's porridge, that Sunday's chicken gravy, and a couple of eggs for pinting. Were you being bound
Fantastic.
Or were they being bound? Lots of haggis-y seasoning. Delish. I love starting the weekend in Whitley Bay with your banter, and it often inspires me to head straight out onto the beach and into the North Sea. Yep, we drive a lot of people that way. Something I try to do a few times a week. We should be moving to Ayrshire in the next few weeks, pandemic permitting. Hopefully, next year, our new local butcher will have more haggis in.
Yeah, hopefully. It could do with a skin on it. It's a brave attempt. I've mentioned this
it's a
before.
A mad attempt. Never mind a brave attempt.
When we moved to Australia in about 1963, 1964, my mum was really missing the haggis, so she scoured the country, couldn't get one, said, oh, I'll make it. And she went to the local butcher and gave her the list of ingredients she wanted. And he gave her the look, he said, what the heck are you doing, woman? Anne Sutherland from Orkney also emailed. She said, last Saturday you were speaking about neeps and tatties with your haggis. In Orkney, as opposed to gravy and mince. You know, to my shame, my daughter phoned me up and says that I prefer mince on my haggis.
See, she's a good girl. Good girl.
Well, she's written out in my will, I'll tell you that. In Orkney, we have Clapshot. Same ingredients, but far better, she says. Mealy tatties, good mealy tatties, and a neat, preferably frosted. Come back to that in a second. Peel tatties and neeps, boil them in the same pot with some salt. Three parts tatties, two parts neep, too much neep, and the clapshot is watery. When boiled, drain, remove from the heat, add the pepper, and a good helping of butter and mash together until smooth and well mixed. Well, we're going to have a whole chat about neeps next week, because, you know, a neep's not just for buns now.
No.
But that whole frosted bit... It does taste sweeter once it's been frosted. Or am I talking nonsense?
There is a certain logic to it, I suppose, because I always think that in autumn, the leaves change colour better after a frost, and it may be because that does something with the sugars, so it's possible that the same thing could happen with a neep. I don't know.
If anybody actually does know what they're talking about.
See, we should try that one week. Actually get somebody on who knows what they're talking about, as opposed to us.
It will ruin the whole ethos of the programme.
Well, it's a very different vibe. We've done quite a lot of recording over the years about different birds, but one of our more memorable trips was just last year when, at long last, we managed to get onto the Bass Rock.
Yeah, we tried quite a few times, but we did succeed, and what a trip. The Rocky Island on the Firth of Forth, home to the largest gannetry colony in Britain, and we were lucky to be shown round by someone who knows this place really well. Maggie Shedden from the Scottish Seabird Centre.
So at this time of year, and particularly today, we have seen a lot of birds leave the rock today and a few days prior. So the gannets now are just holding their territories. There's also non-breeding birds on the rock, and these are the ones that will tend to move as we head up, so you're not disturbing a gannet there. If a gannet's on its territory, it will stick with its territory. Did that one get you?
Yeah.
Lovely.
This is where the camera, all the techie stuff with the camera is installed. Okay. And the centre, really in the middle of fine-tuning all this, we've been having fabulous new cameras in.
What is this?
This is old photographs of the Bass Rock.
Wow.
So you can actually age how the colony increased over the years.
Uh-huh.
So in the 60s, and this was when Brian Nelson was out, and I've got some fabulous photos from them.
That was when I was 1 year old. So there's practically no gannets on it at all. By the time you get to 84, half the island is green, half the island is white. 87 wasn't a particularly good breeding year, but looks like, well, I'm going to say it was good as that.
Well, and then but you can see the increase there.
Yeah, and you get to this in the year 2000, and
it's incredible, isn't it? It's quite amazing.
Oh, we've got one on the steps in front of us. I don't know what it's likely to do.
This is all part of their treacherous journey. At the nest, they were quite safe. And one of the ones I freed down there, you could see it had been attacked. All the new feathers on its head had gone. So it's had a treacherous journey just to get out of the colony and make its way down. Mm-hmm. And then it gets stuck behind the gate, and I come in and grab it by its neck and go, freedom. And let's hope it makes it, because... between 75 to 80% of these young birds in the first year will die. Mortality is incredibly high. And that's, the gannet is growing. But you have got to bear that in mind. We've had incredibly stormy days the last few days. And at the centre, Seabird Centre, I said, you're going to get gannets washed ashore. They said, we've been getting calls already this week. It was an onshore wind. Now, that we see. But if it's an offshore wind, you don't see they've died. And for them to be learning to fish, they're at the mercy of the tides. So they're just being washed in and washed out. Yeah. And that's what, it's really what we don't see.
Yeah. As is often the case with the marine environment, an awful lot of it is invisible to us, and therefore it's easy for folk to ignore.
I'm a bit busier now. Up until now, there's been an occasional bird beside the path. Now they're on it. Hundreds of them.
It's like Hitchcock.
Don't make me laugh.
There's
two birds here in the corner, young gannets on the corner here. For about the last 5-6 years, they have tried to nest on this corner, three of them. Because of COVID this year, they have won the site. And one of them thinks fledged, and it's just, I'm just so pleased they have. I think for the birds that have been breeding, they're just much more relaxed now. They're not bringing in as much. And I think possibly...
Sneak attack from behind. What were you told about leading up against the pole?
I didn't realise they were going to come up from behind, though, and have a go.
You're nearly standing on its nest. What is it about you and birds? They really don't like you.
That's a 6-inch gash in my leg.
Oh, it is not.
Look at it.
It's a scratch.
They're definitely getting more defensive.
Yeah. So this is about as high as we go in the colony. When I first used to land, well, we could really wander all the way up the rock. This was green, there was grass. I used to sit round the side of the chapel in the morning, early morning. It was like, yeah, lovely morning sunrise. Look at it now. And the erosion, the wall behind you here, the chapel wall, when I first started, you could lean on it. And now it's only a few inches high. It's less than a metre, less than half a metre high now. That's how much the erosion has washed down the rock. And we really are down to bare rock now. On this area, further down, I'm still clearing landslides that are just slowly slipping down. You can't absorb this in 10 minutes. I've been coming out here for I don't know how many years, and I still come out here and I see something new every time I learn something. I love it.
What a great way to finish, though. The top of the rock. And just that wall of noise is just mind-blowing.
The sound of the gannets on the Bass Rock there from our trip last September, accompanied by the Queen of the May, Maggie Shedden. Why don't birds
it
like
it was
you?
Just... Well, I don't know. I think I'm obviously a softer target. You intimidate them when you're so tall. It was 5 stitches and it, you know, it healed up. It wasn't too bad. I wouldn't like to moan about it. But I do love the way that the gannets' survival rate depends on how old you get.
Yes,
direct correlation. When I was one, there was none there.
Yeah,
now you're nudging 95, they're doing really well.
They're extraordinarily well, and if I make it over 100, we'll be laughing. There'll be thousands of them. They'll be taking over the world. Yeah, that wound that you got, you remember those tiny, tiny little flesh-coloured plasters you used to get for plukes? You know, something that would cover the end of a pencil. You know, that would have covered 3 of those wounds.
Bandages were needed. I got a complaint from the hire car company about the blood stains on the seat.
Yeah, and not for the first time. If you are a regular listener to our Scotland Outdoors podcast, you'll know that we featured a number of really brilliant sound recordists over the last few months, folk like Chris Watson, Jez Riley French. Ewan and I particularly have been fascinated by the sounds they've collected. So when we thought about going big on birds this week, I thought I would have a go at recording myself, using some of their techniques, some of the birds that visit my feeders at home.
Just to explain the geography of the scene, we've got a clear plastic seed feeder and a wire one full of peanuts, and they're hanging in a tangle of trees. There's a sycamore, a couple of silver birch, and a few straggly conifers. There's grass at the front and an open field at the back. Try and think of it as a stage on 3 levels. Ground level, where seeds and bits of peanuts drop. Mid-level, where the feeders are. That tends to be pretty active. There's a lot of to-ing and fro-ing there. And then you've got the top level, the upper branches of the trees. The wee birds, the sparrows, chaffinches, siskins, blue tits, coal tits, great tits, that kind of thing, tend to colonise the lower stage. They hop about the lawn and zip up and down to the feeders. These little birds are doing fast laps. They fly up, balance on the perch, grab some seeds, straight back down again. Every time a bird grabs a seed from the feeder, they accidentally dislodge another couple of seeds, which then fall to the ground, which is where the dunnocks and the robin just wait for them. There can be 30 or 40 small birds together because, for them, there's safety in numbers.
More of those bird sounds later in the programme. Well, actually, I made a podcast with those recordings. All I did was stick a wee piece of recording equipment up in the branches and then leave it for 5 hours. It's not fun. I should point out the podcast is only 20 minutes long plus, but it's not 5 hours. Head to BBC Sounds and look for Scotland Outdoors if you would like to hear more.
Sound financial advice, that's what we need. We need a bit of chat about it.
We'll meet those who are looking for help and track down the experts who can keep us right.
Kim and Eileen are clever about cash.
That's what we do best.
Well, we can try anyway.
These are crazy days.
We're here to help you navigate these turbulent times.
We would encourage people to get that support before they hit crisis point.
You may have these little pockets of money that is just kind of wasting.
We can look and see if you're on the best deal with your supplier.
Subscribe to Clever About Cash on BBC Sounds.
We're back again.
We sure are, Kim.
Or listen Sunday mornings from 6 on BBC Radio Scotland.
You're listening to Out of Doors on BBC Radio Scotland with me, Mark Stephen, and of course Mr. Ewan McElriff. Heaps more coming up, including an icy trip up Benihee and the bird life of Callander Park in Falkirk.
I was loving listening to that. And the bird song's fine, but that lovely fluttering of the wings, that's just such a great sound. Yeah. But you were talking about them spilling seed. The ones at my feeder, and it sounds almost identical to yours, they're actually going in, the coal tits are going in and picking out the barley and spitting it onto the ground for the dunnocks, because they're after the black seeds, the nigella seeds and our sunflower seeds, things like that. They're getting really picky. Anyway, we've got this mystery bird. Somebody incredibly has got it right.
Wow.
Have a wee listen to this. Yeah, you can email outofdoors@bbc.co.uk. The text number is 80295, and you can call Lewis as well on 0885 92 95 00. I don't know, do we need a clue here or not?
Not quite yet. Let's do it after the 7 o'clock news. See what happens.
They go around in gangs. I'll give you that clue.
Oh, well, fair enough. I'd just like to point out it's not nigella seed. It's Niger seed. I mean,
Nigella says they're called Nigella.
No, your obsession is showing, and remember the terms of the restraining order. Now, the reason we've gone all out in birds this morning is to mark the RSPB's Big Garden Bird Watch, which is happening as we speak. Joining us to tell us more about it and how you can get involved is Carl Stevens, Engagement Officer with RSPB Scotland. Morning, Carl.
Morning.
I cannot believe that there's anyone on the planet who has not heard of Big Garden Bird Watch before, but just in case, explain how it works.
Yeah, it's been going on for quite some time. So essentially, it's been running since 1979, if you can believe that. So this is our 42nd year. And it runs once a year, every year, for 2 or 3 days. So it started yesterday and it runs until tomorrow. And it's essentially the world's largest garden bird survey and probably the biggest and probably the long-running citizen science project in the world. And over the last 42 years... In terms of the sort of number of people that have got in touch, we've had millions of people getting in touch with over 144 bird sightings, which is pretty impressive.
Yeah, but there's a lot of negatives in the past 12 months, but this presumably is a positive. You know, lockdown, this is a perfect thing to do with your family, with your children.
Oh, it really is a perfect thing. I think we all felt the same when we went into lockdown the first time, our first lockdown back in spring last year. It almost felt like we were all going back into hibernation, and it was very clear that people became more aware of their local patch because people couldn't go much further than their local patch. So everybody was aware of all those small things, the changes in the leaves, the changes in the birds, and the behaviour and so on. And it really does make people feel a lot better. And we know that being out in nature or just watching nature, watching birds, has a positive impact on your mental health, on your happiness. Yeah, it brings joy, it brings appreciation, and the more you look, I mean, it seems obvious, but the more you look, the more you do see. And it means you notice those little changes. And there's something quite reassuring knowing that when you're in sort of a mini hibernation yourself, looking out of the window and seeing things happening, you know, the world keeps on spinning. It does help with your feelings. And it's also nice to know that you're doing something to help our wider understanding of the birds of the UK as well.
How strict are the rules there, Carl? You know, because I've done it before, and, you know, it's an hour. And the damn things, the woodpecker arrived about 5 minutes after the hour, and then a brambling. You're kind of really tempted to say, well, sneak them in.
I mean, I should be saying it's incredibly strict. You should be sticking to the hour. However,
we'll send the boys round.
Yeah, between us, you know, no further. But you know, it's roughly an hour. And actually, in that hour, even if you see nothing, I mean, that's pretty unlikely. But even if you see nothing in that hour, that is as important as telling us you've seen a gazillion different birds appearing at your bird table or outside your window. So, it is good. And as I say, the longer you spend. And sometimes people forget the hour, you know, the hour will come and go because people get so engrossed. Because it's essentially like a little soap opera unfolding outside your window, really.
I'm sitting in the car park here in BBC Aberdeen and I can hear robins singing. Now, you know, vast majority of people are going to be able to identify robins. If this is a citizen science project, how confident are you that people are actually identifying what they think they're identifying?
So there's always that element in any citizen science project that people don't know, you know, we're not expecting people to be expert ornithologists here. We're understanding that people have a you know, some level from basic through to sort of professional. And to help that, the RSPB produces a number of guides. So we've got a very handy sort of identification guide because there's essentially a number of birds that you're likely to see in the garden. So we've got a good an identification guide that tells you what they look like, something that helps you guide you into what they sound like. So as you say, some sounds are particularly easy to recognise, like the robin, which I can hear outside already. And when I was listening earlier outside my window, I could hear the robin because they're one of the first birds you'll hear in the dark because they've got big pupils and they're more aware of the light. But essentially, if you follow those guides, we're really just looking for your best understanding of it, of what you can see. If we see something that we think, hang on a second, why have you seen some parrot that's only seen in Brazil? We might take that with a pinch of salt, but otherwise we're kind of pretty confident that people kind of get what they're seeing.
Yeah, I mean, I'm good. I've got about 20 golden orioles on them at the moment, so that probably wouldn't count.
I mean, that's definitely...
And the ostrich, yeah. Correct.
Yeah.
Yeah, but do you need a garden? Because there's going to be folks shouting, you know, this assumption you put the bird feeder in your garden, but the vast majority of people live in towns.
Yeah, no, not at all. I mean, it would be lovely if you had a garden. I don't have a garden. I live on the sort of top floor of a tenement flat in Edinburgh, so I don't have a garden, but I'm lucky enough to have a bit of green space out the back, as many tenements do. And essentially, that is just as good. So if you're able to look out the window and look out a green space, then that pretty much will do the trick. You can also, obviously, if you do, you know, have a window, you can add little feeders to that as well. So you can buy various different feeders online, which will bring some of the birds closer to you. But yeah, essentially, you don't need a garden. If you do have a garden, it's great because in terms of sort of conservation impacts, obviously in terms of how much space gardens in the UK do take up, you know, it's bigger than, you know, the biggest national sort of nature reserve that we have. So there's a lot of impact there. But as I say, you don't need a garden. So you just need a window and a set of eyes, really.
You're an engagement officer, Carl. You know, and obviously this is an excellent piece of engagement with the public. You know, it ties the public and the RSPB together very nicely indeed. Thanks very much. But how genuinely, how important is the science? How important is the data?
It's incredibly important. And I think going back to what you were asking earlier in terms of the sort of citizen science and what can we get from it, I think people, it is a lovely activity. It does bring people together and it gets people to do stuff. But actually, the results that we have, you know, if you think we've been doing this for 42 years now, that's 42 few years of data, which is incredibly helpful. And we can look at trends, essentially, because essentially if we're asking everyone across the country to do this, we can follow some of the trends. And in the past, we've found out quite a lot from this information. So Big Garden Bird Watch was one of the ways that we identified that song thrushes had massively declined. So between 1979 and 2019, there's been an 80% decrease in song thrushes in our gardens. Likewise, an 80% decrease in starlings, and sparrows have gone down by 50%. So there's been a lot of declines, but you also notice any other differences. So last year was quite interesting because there was quite a mild winter, and so we found lots more incidences of long-tailed tits and wrens being seen, like these little wee birds. Because it was a mild winter, they were able to survive. So it really does show up these trends, and it really enables us to kind of find out what we need, what the situation is, and then what we need to do as a result of that.
So useful science and good fun to do too. Thanks very much for joining us this morning, Carl. That was excellent. Thank you.
Thank you.
If you fancy giving the Big Garden Bird Watch a go this weekend, there's a link to the RSPB website from ours. Are you going to do it, Ewan?
Yeah, I'm going to do it because with my Nigella or my Niger seeds, I'm getting an absolute pile of different birds at the moment. We've said this before, I don't know, just because you're going stir crazy in the house or there are more birds coming to you. I don't know, but it certainly seems that way.
Yeah. Interesting. With our bird theme in mind this week, I was thinking in terms of, collective nouns for different types of birds, the nouns of assemblage. And because we've been experimenting, playing a bit with poetry recently, I came up with this.
Tied by one leg to the fence, looking like torn black plastic. No life, no spark, all wit and wisdom gone. A murder of crows. Looking down from the trees, a gentle moaning rising and falling again and again. A pitying of doves. In front of the fence, slow marching atop the ploughed ridges, heads bent with grief, a wake of buzzards. Who could have done such a thing and why? The community was shocked, darkly excited, anxious, chattering nervously, a murmuration of starlings. The press came and spoke to the onlookers. They pecked over the facts, tossed out theories, suppositions, what-ifs, and scattered rumours like chaff. The usual quarrel of sparrows. Without motive or suspect, the fear grew and became shrill, the screech of gulls, the clattering of jackdaws, a scold of jays, and an angry, fearful clamour of rooks. Even the ravens, veterans of many deaths and many battles, muttered at the unkindness of it all. The crime was never solved. No culprit was ever brought to book. Neither the Parliament of Owls nor the Congress of Eagles were able to shine any new light or bring any fresh insight. In time, the crime, like the crows, just faded away, leaving the barbed wire sagging, bare and rusted. But in the grass beneath, bright colours marked the place where murder had once been done. In memoriam corvus, a bouquet of pheasants. And the only sound was the wind in the trees and the distant exultation of larks.
Mark and collective nouns, and the thing about this programme is just some things make you laugh and some just stop and make you think, and There's a lot in there. It's lovely. But we will give a... Should we give the collective for the mystery bird? Is that...
I think if you do that, then folk are going to be able to check it up and they'll get the answer.
They wouldn't do that.
Yeah, they would. Well, I would. Wouldn't you?
Okay, well, let's make it harder. It's the French for brigands.
Yeah. And I think it's from the root from, you know, the verb to steal in the French, obviously.
Yeah, it is. But they do look like brigands and they're out stealing things en masse. 0808 92 95 00. If we've made it too easy for you.
Coming up, the birds of Callander Park in Falkirk. David Lindo, also known as the Urban Birder, joins us live. Really looking forward to that. And Ewan will be learning all about the ancient festival of Imbolc. But first, in a week where we're really celebrating all things avian, we have, of course, a mystery bird, and here's another blast. Connor and
yeah,
Swinbridge.
Got one correct.
Okay, you carry on. You go.
No, well, you've got the answers there.
Oh, well, it's never stopped you in the past. Connor and Slimbridge says, Mystery Bird, for the first time, I've read the show notes on BBC Sounds where it says the mystery bird is known by many names, so I'm going to call it a nettlefinch. Connor, take it seriously. Come on. Jackie in Melrose says, Hubby George thinks the bird is a sedge warbler, but then goes on to say, on the frosted neep front, a clever pal of mine told me that freezing fruit breaks down the fibres and you get more juice. So I slice my lemons and limes, freeze them and use them in gin. I'm thinking it might work with the neeps too. Don't put the neeps in the gin. Bad idea. Lynn D'Agostino in Oakley Fife says, hope you managed to keep warm. Is the bird a wheat here? No, sadly, it's not, Lynn.
Nope.
Gary in Pennycook says, sounds like a swallow. Nope. Mary in Tobermory, is the mystery bird stonechat? These are all good guesses, but not quite there.
Satisfyingly wrong. But you're right about the breaking down of the fibres, because when I'm doing cider, we chuck the apples in the freezer. And that breaks it up completely and you get much more juice out of them.
Right.
Top tip for this morning. Get in touch. Email out of doors at bbc.co.uk. I can't believe I'm giving tips on making cider. Text number 80295. Give Lewis a call. Give him your recipes. 0808 92 95
00. It's snowing here, or it was snowing here in the car park earlier this morning. So, you know, the ground is white. It's astonishing how the landscape changes, and not just the landscape changes, but how we feel about the landscape, you know, when it snows or when you've got serious ice. Even walks we know well can be completely transformed. Sometimes just the desire to get out in it is just overwhelming.
Ordinarily, after the programme on a Saturday morning, I'll confess I go back home, and often I'll go back to bed for a couple of hours because we have to get up stupid o'clock in the morning. But today, it was just too fine. The sun came up at about 25 to 9, just across the horizon, which gladdened my heart enormously because I was clocking it just at the start of the year at about 9:15. So it's definitely getting better. We're getting more daylight. But as I was coming back from Aberdeen, I took the top road by Park Hill, and Benihee just looked absolutely superb. It was like a sort of, I don't know, Christmas cake, wedding cake confection, just covered in snow. And I thought, that is for me. And I decided to delay the gratification. Rather than go up from the Benihee Centre, which I thought would be pretty busy, I came to the back of Benihee, just outside Oyne. Still quite a few cars about, and I've seen quite a few people on the path. But nowhere near as many, as I suspect, as if I'd gone to the other two. And when I say delayed gratification, you start off coming through the trees, and it's kind of dark. But, you know, the sun is shining through the trees every so often, you just see these patches of light in the ground. And you climb, and you climb, and you climb, and eventually you come out the trees, but you're still in the shade, because you've got the hill between you and the sun. So you sort of still climb and circle round, and all of a sudden, you step into, and I know this is an overused phrase, and I make no apology for using it, a winter wonderland. It is just gorgeous. There's hardly any wind at all. There's been snow, and obviously it's frozen quite hard. But the trees are just covered in snow.
And it's heavy. You can see it's kind of pulling them down, pulling the branches down a bit. It's conifers mostly up here. Where the heather is sticking up from the ground, the wind's caught it. There's been obviously a sort of freeze-thaw cycle. So there's globules of ice at the end of the heather. The snow itself is quite crisp. You can hear it. And where I am is one of the tops, Craig Shannock. And the rock here sits in folds. It's a bit like a pile of pancakes, to be honest. And the snow comes down at the top of the rock, and it's just melting, thawing, just at the edge. Oh, right. See when I said there was hardly a breath of wind? More fool me. Whew. I've come out of the shelter. There's actually plenty of wind. I don't know what I was talking about. I was talking rubbish as usual. And there's a signpost here for Baca Ben Hee. Just come that way, so I don't understand the point in that. But the other side of the signpost, I have no idea, because it's covered in ice. I don't know if I can get that off. No, come on. What does it say? Quarry Trail. Oh, me. That's just fabulous. The low-lying land... Actually, I'm going to come out of the wind. You'll never hear a word I'm saying. The low-lying land is still green and brown. But up here on the tops, everything's white and pristine. I said, and once you get out of the wind, just calm and still and beautiful, and it just uplifts your soul being up here. You couldn't be depressed up here in this kind of weather. It's just too bright, it's too light, it's too sparkling. You know, I've often said that it looks as if someone's strewn diamonds across the ground. They have. And the snow's not white. You know, it is starlight in places, if that's a colour. In other places, it's dark blue and purples. There's hardly any colour coming through the trees at all because they're so covered in snow. But where the rock has been exposed, it's greys and pinks and greens. And I can see right out to sea from here. There's cloud out on the sea itself, but not above me. This is clear blue skies. And about a mile and a half away, I can see Mither Tap, and I can see people moving on the top of Mither Tap. But where I am, nobody. Peace, perfect peace. Underneath an outcropping of rock at the moment. So you could just see it kicking through the layers of snow and ice. And rhyme. And there's a tiny, tiny little Christmas tree. Probably about 2 feet high. And it's just solid. Absolutely solid with snow and ice. And it'll survive and it'll thaw. It probably won't grow much bigger than that where it's growing at the moment. I've no idea how they managed to seed themselves up there. It must be birds. But this is just a completely different world up here. You know, it's cold and it's frosty down at sort of the green level, but not like this. This is just enchanted. It's wonderful. Top of the world stuff, this.
That was Ben Hee last Saturday in all its snowy glory. It's beautiful.
It just lifts your spirit. I'm just looking out over a snowy winter wonderland, as you said. Mm. And I got up this morning and I just smiled. Just as simple as that. You go, wow, yeah. This is fantastic. It just lifts your spirits. And also, it's quite a philosophical element to the out of doors now and again.
Mm-hmm.
But the programme used to be the programme that makes you greet, and now it's the programme that makes you think.
Yeah, we should try it sometime. We heard before the news from Carl Stevens from RSPB Scotland about the big garden bird watch that's happening this weekend. Very, very easy to take part. There's a link to their website from ours, and it's something that everybody can get involved in. With that in mind, we asked writer and reviewer Rebecca Smith and her kids, Ellis, age 10, and Jess, age 3, to have a go at bird watching in their garden. Now, to be honest, that didn't go quite to plan as the birds weren't playing, but undeterred, they headed for a local park to see what they could spot there instead.
Ellis, could you put your boots on, please? Or your wellies, actually.
Let me tuck that in. What birds do you think we'll see?
Robins.
Robins, excellent. Anything else?
Blackbirds.
Blackbirds. What about woodpeckers?
No, they're rare.
They're rare?
Mm-hmm. We might hear them.
Right. Hats. Should we go this way, that way, or that way?
That way. I thought out that way.
Wow, it's really muddy, isn't it?
Yeah, go out and I worry. I want to talk to kind bird.
What do you want, darling?
Air kind bird.
You want to see other kinds of birds?
Yeah, water birds.
There's a lock down here. What do you think we'll see on the lock?
Ducks, swans, coots.
That's right, yeah. Let's stay stand still, just listen to that sec. That one there, what do you think?
What's his song?
And here's the bottom of the loch at Callander Park. It's very muddy and wet today. My recorder is getting quite damp. Let's go down there, down towards the water. Careful, it's very slippy. Woo!
Are they coots?
I think they're coots. I have to say, I always get coots and moorhens mixed up. I can't remember which one's which.
I think moorhens have, is it red beaks or red heads? And then coots have white heads.
Put them down there. What's that down there?
That one's on the ice.
Listen to the noise it's making on the ice.
Yeah.
It's almost metallic.
And it, like, when it tries to get up, it breaks quite a bit of ice off.
What do you think? You like them?
Yeah. If you make, like, that's a moorhen. That's a coot. Yeah, the moorhens do have, like, a red face.
Definitely that way around.
Sure. I'm 99% sure.
Look at the size of his legs.
Yeah, they're enormous.
And they're climbing on the ice, aren't they?
Yeah. I can hear them climbing on the ice.
Hmm. He's almost skating on the ice.
Yeah. And there's one over there.
Oh, that's a different kind of duck.
Oh.
I can't remember what type that is. I'll have to take a picture of that and have a look. Oh, they are very
look
different.
At that one. It's got, like, hair behind it.
Like a little tuft at the back of his head.
Yeah. And over there, a coot climbed up onto the ice, climbed over there, and went onto that tree.
What's that?
Rex.
What colour is that duck?
White. Black.
That's right. That duck is black and white with a kind of blue beak. And he looks very soft and smooth. And his friends are all kind of darker brown, aren't they? But also with a blue beak and quite orange eyes. We'll have to look them up when we go home.
We've just had a play at the park. We're about to start heading back home. Which way should we go back home, do you think?
That way.
Wait a sec. Listen, what's that? Oh, is that a woodpecker?
I think so, yeah. Listen to that. I think it sounds like it's coming from the trees. Yeah, it is. It's coming from the trees.
Can we see it? Let's have a look. We're just in Callander Park, just next to the lock. Just next... yeah.
I think it's from behind the tree.
Yeah. Just next to the path
there,
that...
There.
Can you see it?
On the left tree. On the left tree. To on... the... So, not that tree up there, but over there.
On the far furthest tree?
On
oh,
the
yeah, yeah, yeah.
Left tree, and up a bit, near the centre. So, if you follow the trunk up... The right one, the one that turns right, the big one, but then turns left, then right again. It's up there.
Okay. Should we go a bit closer?
Okay.
Not too close now, because it might not do it. Just stay still, let's see if it does it again. Well, I think he's had his lunch for today. And I think it's time for ours as well. Yeah. Should we head back?
Yeah, that was cool.
Rebecca Smith there, along with Ellis and Jess, proving you're never too young to start bird watching.
Yeah, they were pretty knowledgeable. I love that.
Yeah,
it's a good one. That? It was something like that. Very, very knowledgeable. I couldn't work out if that was that Jess or was that Ellis, who was pretty spot on. But getting that woodpecker as well.
Ellis, I think.
Brilliant.
Yeah.
It was Ellis. Hey, mystery bird, Byron E. Simpson in Alnwick says, is it a willow warbler? No, it's not. Is it a sedge warbler? No, it's not. And she goes on to say, I've had long-tailed tits and a red pole on my feeders in Northumberland this week. I bet they don't turn up for the survey. Love the show. Why else would I wake up earlier on a Saturday than I have to do for work during the week? Well, thank you very, very much. Lawson John said, or Lewis and John, from Good Morning Boys.
Rothy Norman.
Thank you. Yeah, from Rothy Norman. Once more, you're doing your bit to keep the nation's brain cells alive. Well, the few we have left anyway. Is your wee bird a twit? No, it's not. If not, even the boss admits she's clueless. Now there's a first. And thank you, Mark, for last week's Tam O'Shanter. Brilliant rendition and quite made the day. A lot of people were bowled over by that. A few folks said the best rendition of Tam O'Shanter they've heard on the radio ever.
Very great. Thank you. Well, Carol in Switzerland says, is it a goldfinch? And that's Snowy Greets from Switzerland, she says. No, it's not, I'm afraid. Daniel Cairn said, the bird was quite obviously my granny's budgie Joey. Daniel, take it seriously. Pam and Lossie says, is mystery bird a goldfinch? From beautiful spring like Lossie, no snow here. Keith in Hertfordshire thought it might be a starling. Barry Sutherland says, Danica a hedge sparrow. And then he adds, I sometimes wonder if Barry communicates in code. Saw a meat fly on the patio yesterday. I'm just going to let that lie there. Yeah, saw meat fly in the patio. That's what he said. I'm just reading what's in front of me. Ross in Tenault says, is the mystery bird a linnet? Nope. And Ruth in Glasgow says, is the mystery bird a redpole? Sound a bit like the mob that visited my garden one morning a few years ago. Close, but not quite. No coconut. Let's go back to the recordings now I made of the bird life I've got, just in my back garden. I've got a wee recorder. It's about the size of an old-fashioned mobile phone, and I just bunged it in some branches, and I left it there for 5 hours. And when I listened back, yes, there was lots of little birds, and you hear the whirring and the wings and things, but there were plenty of bigger birds about too. If a predator, a sparrowhawk say, comes barreling through, and for a small bird that's like death knocking at your front door, the hawk has got just milliseconds to pick one target out of dozens, all of which are panicking and flying in different directions. If the sparrowhawk guesses wrong, all the little birds get away. Occasionally they don't all get away, and I find the sparrowhawk on ground level with something dead in its taloned feet. It's always the hawk's eyes that draw mine. Chrome yellow,
cold, quite calculating, which is entirely understandable because pity, compassion, hesitation even, would end up killing this bird. To survive, it needs to be what it is, nothing more, nothing less. There are big birds down on ground level too, wood pigeons, as fat and ponderous as medieval bishops. Their smaller cousins, collared doves, a bird that was unknown in this country before about the 1950s, are less than half their size. And when they fly, their wings whistle.
I think if you listen to that long enough, you would probably begin to be able to determine what kind of bird was flying past.
Yeah, and the other thing I've noticed, I was recording a mystery bird a couple of weeks back, and just playing the sound, and the birds come into it. It's really, really quite effective. Yeah. We say, you know, quite a few folk getting this right, but Bryony Stimson in Alnwick, she said, was it a willow warbler or a sedge warbler? I said, no, you won't. But Bryony, you're going to kick yourself when I tell you what this is. Trust me on that.
Yeah, it can't be helped. Like, writer, broadcaster, photographer and naturalist David Lindo is known as the urban birder and spends his time passing on his passion for birds to others. Delighted to see he joins us this morning. Good morning, David.
Good morning, guys. I'm really enjoying the show, by the way.
Oh, that's very kind of you to say so. Thank you. Listen, I hope this isn't a rude question, but, you know, you were born and brought up in London to Jamaican parents. Is it just my imagination, or, you know, are there fewer people of colour interested in bird watching? Are you unusual?
This is a very vexed question, actually. Yes, I guess I am. I mean, when I started birding, I was 5 years old, and it wasn't last year, it was a little while ago, and I was the only one. And in fact, for years and years and years, I probably only came across maybe seven, ethnically diverse birders in the UK ever. You know, I think numbers are increasing. I think things are slightly different now, but there is a problem. And I think part of the problem not only is the fact that people don't feel as if it's for them, but it's also how nature is sold to us as consumers. I think it's always, or has always seemed to be, towards a countryside type thing and for the middle classes, which I think a lot of people living in urban areas think, well, that's not for me, and they kind of move on.
Well, what about you then? I mean, what was it about birds in particular that grabbed your attention? Oh, well, obviously, it was a big hit for you.
Yeah, but you know what? I know you're gonna probably laugh now when I tell you this, but I feel that I had a previous life, and I think in my previous life I was a puma. And I think I used to hunt birds, and I think one day I missed one and it flew off, and I thought, wow, that looks amazing. So I became a birding puma, which led to my demise because I wasn't eating. But I thought, I'm onto something interesting here, and I wonder and I hope that if I have another life, I'd like to explore that. And then I was born in Northwest London as a human, so I think it kind of worked from there, because when I was born, I had this innate interest in natural history, which actually started with insects. No one around me, not my parents, their friends, my friends, had any interest in it at all, because I was raised in a black and Irish community. So I had no mentor, and I taught myself, you know. And initially, you know, I didn't know what birds were because no one could tell me. So I called blackbirds starlings mummy birds and things like that. And I was always told that you can only see wildlife in the countryside, but I had no one to take me. So I kind of inadvertently became a urban birder because I watched birds around me, my urban surroundings in London. And I realised that there was a hell of a lot to be seen. And I didn't actually meet anyone in terms of a birder until I was 11. And by that point, I was a walking encyclopedia, especially on birds of Britain, Europe, Middle East and North Africa.
So are you doing that in a park, or are you just sitting on a bench, or are you looking out your window?
I was sitting in my bedroom in my bedroom, right, looking out my back window, and I used to do it every day religiously, especially before going to school. So I'd get up early in the morning, you know, before dawn, and wait till dawn, watching over my back garden. So it started from there, you know, and then I realised that birds were everywhere.
Just as you were speaking there, we've got foxes in the car park, and one of our urban foxes just ran past, and I'm delighted to say that the bad leg it had 2 weeks ago seems to be on the mend, which is good. When I lived just outside Glasgow, I live in rural Aberdeenshire nowadays, I mean, it couldn't be more rural if I tried, but when I lived in just outside Glasgow, what I got really good at was finding wildlife in really unlikely situations. It's surprising. You become... You almost like a master of low-level ecstasy, you know. Oh, look, I found a such and such.
Yeah, I mean, I totally believe that. I mean, there's been about 620 different species of bird, for example, registered on the British list since records began back in whenever it was. And of that, around about 95% have been found in urban areas, including some mega rarities. Which actually just goes to show that anything can turn up anywhere at any time. And I think that's one thing that I learned early doors. For example, when I first saw kestrels at my school, my primary school used to have a wood, and I saw a kestrel hovering over the wood, and I was so excited. I was about 8 years old, and I ran in and told my headmaster, "Sir, I've just seen that kestrel." And he said, "No, you haven't." I said, "But..." He said, "No, you haven't. They only turn up in the countryside. You have not seen the kestrel." And I think, you know, ever since then, I've been trying to prove him wrong.
What can you do to actually attract them? I mean, obviously, you know, you cast your bread upon the waters to a certain extent. You know, you're going to get more birds back in. What do you do to attract more wildlife towards you?
Well, if you're lucky enough to have a garden, I think one of the first things to do is to have areas of your garden that's given across to nature, really, because I've seen too many gardens with astroturf and wooden fencing and flora that isn't native to the UK. All of those things add up to no or very few invertebrates, which in turn mean that you're not going to get many birds. So the first thing is to try and reverse that. Even if you have a garden which has a patio and stuff, just try and have a corner where you just let it run riot a little bit, so that, you know, it attracts invertebrates. The other thing to do is to put out bird food, which seems obvious, and in fact it is one of the best things to do. I am an advocate for feeding all year round. Mm. Obviously, during the summer, spring and autumn, you don't put so much out. But the idea is that because your feeding stations are there, the local birds, because they do circuits, especially in late summer when the young are out and they're just exploring the terrain for the first time, they know that your food's there. And they tend to feed on natural things when they can find it. But then when winter comes, they know exactly where to go. So that's one way of really bringing birds into your world. And it's such a great thing when that happens, because they bring so much joy.
Mark was recording the birds at his feeder, but there seems to be, pardon the pun, a pecking order as to which species go at the top, which go at the bottom, which will go at the bird table, which feed underneath it.
Yeah, there is a hierarchical scenario going on. The problem is, in many ways, you're getting a collection of different species all in the same spot at the same time. And this kind of behaviour of pecking order would not normally be seen so often. But because you're bringing them all together, then obviously it all kicks off. So birds like robins, for example, and grey tits are quite dominant. Down south, in southern England, you got the additional scenario of parakeets, and I believe that the parakeets are on the march heading north. I'm sure you probably had a few in Scotland, no?
Yeah, I think we have, yeah. Actually. Edinburgh, yeah. They've been spotted.
Yeah, I thought so. Well, the research has shown that, you know, they are a bit bullies at the bird table, and they kind of get the other birds stressed out when they swoop in and sort of take over. So, yeah, you got that scenario happening. The way to kind of try and minimize it is firstly to look at what sort of feeders you're putting out, because you could put out, I suppose, broadly speaking, feeders that have a cage around them to stop parakeets and even squirrels from entering, but letting the small birds in. And also it depends on the quality of food you feed them as well, because if you give them food which you've bought cheaply, which contains, for example, cereals, cheap cereals, then you're going to be getting lots of pigeons turning up as well, who again themselves, because of their sheer size, get other birds a bit nervous. So it's better quality you put out, the better range of food you put out, means that you'll have more of a chance of spreading the love and less less fighting, even though you can't avoid it.
Yeah, have you noticed? I'm fairly certain I know what the answer to this is, but have you noticed what you might describe as a lockdown uplift in bird watching?
Yes, and that's great. I mean, I love the idea that people, especially in urban areas where most of us live, are noticing nature, and that's all. You know, that's my life. Right, I'm trying to engage people in urban areas to appreciate nature and to know about conservation, but through the medium of birds. So, you know, last year when we unfortunately had our first lockdown, you know, the number of people who were contacting me, and plus I was seeing it in social media, was going crazy about the fact that, you know, I've seen this, I've heard that, you know, and it was great because the world was quieter and, you know, we were hearing more birdsong. What's interesting, even though we were hearing more birdsong because of less hubbub, I think the birds themselves were hearing more birdsong because they were hearing their rivals for the first time. And when hearing rivals, it makes them even more fervent. So you're hearing amplified dawn choruses, and it was amazing. And plus, the fact that people were discovering birds that they'd never seen before, even though they're always there, you know, it was just fantastic. And the third thing is that, you know, anything can turn up anywhere at any time. I remember being in the garden, someone's garden near Gatwick Airport, and I was just showing this person some of the birds, you know, that were flying over the garden and stuff. And all of a sudden, a kingfisher flew past, and this garden was nowhere near a river, you know. And it's amazing. And this sort of things probably happen every day, but we just don't look up. We're not there to see it.
It wouldn't matter what age you were, you're going to get excited about that. You know, the big
Listen,
kid
I was
resides
excited.
In. Well, exactly. David, thank
I've
you very
seen
much.
Hundreds.
Thank you very much for joining us this morning. That's been very kind of you. Thank you.
No problem. Thank you.
Right. David Lindo there.
Right.
And you can find a link to David's website from ours. You're listening to Out of Doors here on BBC Radio Scotland. I'm Mark Stephen. He's Ewan McElraith. If you miss any of this, there are a few ways of listening again.
There is nowhere to hide, but you can start catching up whenever you want by looking up the programme on BBC Sounds.
Or you can download the free Scotland Outdoors podcast, which is available from BBC Sounds. We like hearing where people listen to the podcast, so you can email us that information at outofdoors@bbc.co.uk, which is what David Hunt in Canada did. This fits in absolutely perfectly with our bird theme this week, and he says, good morning, Mark and Ewan, and greetings from snowy Richmond Hill, Ontario. You are a staple of my weekly podcast schedule, keeping me company as I've worked from home since March 2020 through four seasons and two lockdowns. I'm a particular fan of the mystery bird, but sadly have a poor record of correctly guessing the answer.
Yeah, well, here's a mystery. Last winter, we had a steady procession of birds to our feeders to keep us entertained. Cardinals, jays, goldfinches, and more than a few woodpecker sightings. So far this year, we've had very few birds to the feeders beyond the occasional, and I've no idea what this is, a juncos, and chickadees, and the odd cardinal. And then today, we've had a driving snowstorm and birds galore at the feeders. Mm. Time will tell, I suppose. Keep up the good work, gent. Stay safe and stay healthy. David Hunt.
Right, just time for one more blast of the mystery bird before we reveal the answer.
So, if you know what that is, and there's quite a few, I'll give you a clue. The collective's a volery from the French for brigands. Text 80295, you can call as well. Lewis is having a busy morning. 08 085 92 95 00.
Quick fox update. I said that it looks as if its leg was getting better. It just went back across the car park, and I saw the side with the bad leg. Not so great, I'm afraid. Yeah. Not so great. It's a young fox, but you know, it's definitely carrying one of its back legs, as in raising it. Jackie Morris is an author and illustrator. Back in the first lockdown, she was asked to contribute to the Book of Hopes, edited by the children's author Catherine Rundle. When we spoke to Jackie recently for the Scotland Outdoors podcast, she very kindly read an extract from her contribution to that book, and it's called Hope, or Learning the Language of Birds.
In the years to come, you would think of this time as the time of great quiet. It would seem to you then that the earth was holding her breath, waiting, watching, cars silent in the streets, planes absent from the sky. After a week, the air would seem cleaner, colours brighter. But the night seemed darker, perhaps because the stars glowed brighter. Fear wandered the dreams of some, anxiety stalked, and you would wake in early morning as the light slipped into each day and listen. You would hear sweet notes rising with the sun to greet the light. You would hear across the silence a response. You would listen as other voices lifted to song. You would begin to learn each different voice, begin to see them. And soon they were no longer just birds, but became wren. Robin. Blackbird. Thrush. Greenfinch. Goldfinch. Sparrow. Jay. And you would follow the textures of birdsong, call and response, as it moved with the sun. And you would feel for the first time how the sun was lifted into the sky each day on birdsong. You would feel the turning of the earth beneath your feet as the song travelled with the path of the light. You would hear the turning of the world as each day dawns at the edge of darkness, at the edge of the light. You would know that others were listening as the song moved with the light. And you would learn that, if for a while it seemed that the earth stood still, holding her breath, if it seemed that the nights were darker, somewhere on the turning world the sun was rising. The birds were singing. A wave of song in an ocean of sky. And you would know that others, too, would hear those voices. Out of the silence, just before dawn, you would find the threads of hope as the breath of birds became song.
Jackie Morris reading for the Book of Hopes there, and you can hear more from Jackie in next week's midweek edition of Scotland Outdoors, where we discuss her favourite birds and beasts. It's been a birdie week all round. Still the moment you've all been waiting for, this week's mystery bird. We've got correct answers here from Catherine, listening from a rainy starport on Severn, Worcestershire. She says, I think it's a blah. Looking forward to the Big Garden Bird Watch this weekend. Marion Nagiri says, it's a fuffet. A fuffet. Also, a blah. Mark and Woodley, Sutherland says, is it up? Yes, it is. Thanks for your great show. Patricia and Blair Gowrie got it right. Susie from Spot. Katie Perth. Ian Loch Gaelic. Neil from Bewley M in Stirling. Barbara Linkiter, Garganach. Richard and Mandy in Exeter. Willie the Farmer in the Abrechen. Nicky in Banton. And David Milton Keynes. They all got the correct answer.
Hard to believe, but it's just absolutely stumped me, unless it was the clues. But yeah, it was of course a long-tailed tit, and the long-tailed tit is a bird of many names. I've just filled the various bird feeders outside my kitchen window. There's peanuts, there's fat balls and wild seeds, plus the remains of a haggis. And it's an absolute delight to watch. Within minutes the coal tits arrived, then a woodpecker. There's blackbirds feeding on the barley, that the finches are chucking out as they search for sunflower seeds. There's rooks in the background beginning to look for nest sites, but for me, the real delight is happening right now. And of course, this isn't competitive, but what I'm seeing just now doesn't feature on Mark's bird table. Because there's a volerie, from voler in French, which means to steal, or bandits, or a coven, or a congregation, or a stick, of 11 long-tailed tits, which have just arrived en masse. And they're having a real go at the peanuts. They only stay about 5 minutes, then they're off, and I don't usually see them again until dusk. Tiny wee birds, with a tail about twice as long as its body, weighing no more than a £1 coin. They are beautiful. But there's nothing more sociable and has more local names than a long-tailed tit. The bum barrel isn't really a member of the tit family at all. It's a closer relative to the babblers of India and South Asia, which also sport an excessively long tail. These are delightful birds, and unlike many that throng our hedgerows, are doing well, and the numbers are increasing. Possibly because, like much of our wildlife, we've stopped persecuting them. The bum barrel, or barrel tom, got its name from the exquisite barrel-shaped nest, which the featherpoke, or the jack-in-a-bottle, starts building about now. It's an oval, domed, egg-shaped nest with a tiny, elasticated opening at the top. An intricate mixture of wool and moss, bound and felted together with spider's web silk and lined with up to 1,500 feathers, which it gathers in the wild or from dead birds, and often makes a daily, if risky, visit to the plucking post of a goshawk, peregrine or sparrowhawk to collect feathers. Once the shell is built, the puddle net poke, or parley, camouflages the nest with as many as 4,000 lichen flakes. Over 6,000 individual actions are needed to build just one nest. A nest so delightful on the eye, they were collected to decorate the salons of Victorian Britain. A study of the construction of the dog-tail or bottle-builder nests revealed that the spider silk is used to form small loops that snare the tiny hook-like leaves on the moss, creating a strong bond that prevents the nest falling apart, even when it's full of youngsters. And you have to wonder if the person who invented Velcro ever watched long-tailed farmers making a nest. Now, the poke pudding, or long-tailed mag, is a sociable bird. In the winter, they can cram together for warmth with up to 50 birds in one hollow in a tree. In addition, they puff up their pink, white and black plumage to trap air, looking like a ball of cotton wool, hence the name Mumruffin. And that warmth is essential. Up to 50% of these birds will die due to the cold. They put a lot of work into building the nest, but sadly failure is common. Now most birds, if the eggs fail, lay some more and start again. But the billy featherpoke, or pinpriddle, is more family-minded and will attach itself to the nest of a close relative, helping build the nest and raising the young. And that nest, that caring for the wider family, has marked the nimble tailor, or bum towel, as an inspiration for poets throughout the ages. John Clare is the quintessential English romantic poet. Born in 1793, he was captivated by the ovenbird, the long tod, the creek mouse and the barrel tom. Bum barrels twit on bush and tree, scarce bigger than a bumblebee. And in the white thorn's leafy rest, it builds its curious pudding nest. We haw besides as if a mouse has built the little barrel house. The bell ringer, the French pie, the hedge jug and the can bottle, the list goes on and on. And according to naturalist John Lewis Stemple, bird names have become standardised, homogenised, conscripted into what is considered proper by scientists for classification. But according to him, a century ago, a birder could have told what county, even what village he was in, by the folk name for the long-tailed tit. The Bumbar, Huggin' Muffin, Juffet, Fuffet, Bottle Tom, Bottle Bird, Patiny, Ragamuffin, Bottle Tit, Long-tailed Chittering, Bush Oven, Oven Bird, and Milthrum. Nothing in Britain has more names than the Flying Lollipop.
I think that must have the award for the most amount of names.
Just incredible. I love that thing. You can identify which village you're in by the name for the long tail. Incredible.
The bit about the lichen and the spider web, however, Velcro was inspired by cocklebur, which is a type of plant. And it was a Monsieur de Mestral, who was a Swiss engineer. He was hiking in the Jura Mountains.
Well, at least it's not competitive.
Not in the slightest. Not at all. Time for a final listen to some of the bird sounds I captured the other week. It wasn't all tuneful because there was a fair amount of squawking going on as well.
And then you have the upper stage. About three quarters of a mile away up in the village, there's a rookery which is just jammed back full of these very smart, very argumentative, highly sociable birds. Rooks only look black from a distance. If you catch them up close in winter sun, their feathers shine with iridescent blues, purples and greens. Height for a rook means safety, so that tends to be where they stay, up top. If they do come down to ground level, all we have to do is move around behind the kitchen window, one of them will sound the alarm and then whoosh, they're all off. I'll leave you with this one last sound, which I think was caused by a great tit, but I can't say for sure. Great tits are very curious. They're very inquisitive animals, as are rooks. But I think that if it was a rook, it probably would have knocked the equipment out of the tree, so I'm going to go for great tit. This is what it sounds like when one decides to attack your microphone.
Little brute.
Fantastic. But a few folk get in touch about bird tables. Neil in Anglesey says, Callander Park was absolutely pivotal during my childhood. Being a bear, my love of all things wildlife related was fostered there. And Terry in Linlithgow said, I'd like to ask Ewan, what's the secret of getting birds to flock to Niger from Nigella seeds? I put a few different kinds and they just don't seem to want to take it.
Really?
They're giving them the body swerve. Any advice?
Well.
Many thanks for a magnificent programme. Well, thanks for that. I don't know. My birds certainly love it. Maybe you've got too many other good things because they will kind of pick the favourites. But this next piece came about after we both received a letter from Cairn and Shetland to mark Imbolc, once a really important festival and now largely forgotten. Now, my card managed to reach me. The address was lovely. Ewan McElraith, BBC Banff. Hats off to the post office. Just fantastic guys in the post office. Because the postman gave me it with the biggest smile ever. And in the card, Cairn highlights the importance of remembering some of these forgotten dates.
And she writes in the card I've got, Imbolc, return of the sun, brightest blessings from Cairn in Shetland.
Something stirred deep, deep in the ground. A murmur glowed and formed and grew in the depths of the frozen crust. An awakening serpent opened an eye and looked upward. A life force stirring. The call had come. Time to follow the serpent path, the path lit by the energy of the earth. Slowly, the force of life emerged, yawning and stretching into the early morning dawn. Behind it, January and all its ills. The cold, the snow, the frost, the ice, the deadness of winter. Before her, February, March and spring, new life and hope at last upon this earth. Imbolic, Imbo, the spring's beginning, the quickening of the year. Imbolic, in the belly of life, a celebration of the gentle curve of a just showing pregnancy. The growth of returning light, a rebirth, a new beginning. Winter is dead and spring has come of children, foals, calves and lambs. In the Celtic lands, this is an important feast and honours the great pagan goddess Brigid, or Bride, or Bridget, the goddess of healing, of poetry, of fire, of sun, the goddess of birth, fertility and children. Brigid is the exalted one. She is said to lean over every cradle. She is everything good in the world as it turns its back on darkness. Adopted by the church in about 1453, St. Brigid became the protector of cattle and farm work and is known in the Hebrides as the foster mother of Christ. But the story of Bride goes way, way back into the very formation of these Celtic lands. I am older than Brigid of the Mantle. I put songs and music on the wind before ever the bells of the chapels were rung in the west or heard in the east. And I have been a breath in your heart. And the day has its feet to it that will see me coming into the hearts of men and women like a flame upon dry grass, like a flame of wind in a great wood. And she lives on to this day in the land of the Celt. Parents and children will make a Brigid cross, a cross made of reeds intricately woven into a cross and decorated with snowdrops or the feather of swan, the ribbon of memory and the love of those yet to come. A bridey doll. Children and parents take scraps of cloth, depending on your skill, and make a doll stuffed with wool, herbs, dried flowers, memories, and sealed with a prayer or a spell for the future. Plant a seed as a family, and sow with hopes and dreams and love. Visit a well or a stream. Ribbons are dipped in the water and tied to a tree to dry, to carry messages of hope and healing to those in need. Or mother, daughter, grandchild, and bake a cake of bride, of seeds for the future, eggs for fertility, and beat together for the future. For a grandmother's memory lives on in the mind of children forevermore. A memory passed through cake and story, through song and rhyme, a memory that stretches back to the belly of life. The light has come, the fires are lit.
Yeah, it's lovely that.
Light at the end of the tunnel. Spring is quite definitely on its way. We just need to hang on just a little longer.
Yeah, sun's coming up as well. It's just all looking so positive.
Yeah.
Leslie Young said on the Facebook page, I see lots of crows, pigeons, magpies and seagulls where I live. I put out nuts and seeds beside the block of flats. I've got three squirrels around too, but not many smaller birds. I'm actually looking at two squirrels going round and round a tree at the moment. They're obviously setting up territories, but it's fantastic.
Ewan in Fife, different Ewan, says, just listen to your description of Benny. He awesome. Took the family up Bishop Hill last week and we got the same feeling. Amazing day. Jim in Shetland says, great emotions from Benny. My first job as a vet in the early 80s was at Inverurie. Every Tuesday I used to scale Benachie with my dog Vela. We even entered the Kilty race. Happy memories. And Fiona Campbell in Oban says, great piece on the snowy vista on Benachie with gorgeous music. Says, thank you very much. We think the music was from Edward Scissorhands, but we're not just 100% sure.
Well, it worked really well, whatever it was.
Yeah, too straight. Sadly, that's all from us for today. I hope you enjoyed it. Don't forget the Scotland Outdoors podcast at noon and our midweek podcast on Wednesday, which this week is a chance to hear more from author and illustrator Jackie Morris. Fascinating woman, a real talent. Until the next time, from all of us here, thanks for listening.